The concept of bookends, and I remember when Paul started writing it, and he was very excited that it was going to have this thematic element. The concept was to take side one and let there be a bunch of songs that progressed from youthfulness to old age in their lyric, in their feeling, in the tempo, in the spirit of the song. Everything about the opening cut should represent adolescence, and everything about the final cut should be slow and winter-like.
What's that you say, Mrs. Robinson? Joe to Joe has left and gone away. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey.
Hi, I'm Art Garfunkel in the studio for our album Bookends.
About the time you start thinking of the music of Simon and Garfunkel being an anachronism relegated to the oldies bin, something amazing seems to happen. For instance, long before there were DVDs and DirecTV, Simon and Garfunkel reunited in New York City's Central Park in 1981. Not only was the enormous turnout of the event a testament to their enduring star power, but the video of it has become an icon on public television for over two decades now. And who'll ever forget the New York City-based Saturday Night Live telecast, the first following the devastation of September 11, 2001, opening with Paul Simon singing The Boxer, surrounded by the grim yet defiant phalanx of New York City firefighters and police officers. But in March 1968, Simon and Garfunkel released the album Bookends into a world where LBJ's decision not to seek re-election left the White House up for grabs for awaiting Richard Nixon. A world where the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy had not yet stolen the rock generation's innocence. Writing in the All Music Guide, Tom Jurek reminds us, and I quote, "The songs Mrs. Robinson, A Hazy Shade of Winter, At the Zoo, and America offer as tremblingly bleak a vision for the future as anything done by the Velvet Underground, but rooted in the lives of everyday people," says Jurek. But the Bookends album is also a warning that to pay attention is to take as much control of one's fate as possible. End quote. Even before the album Bookends, Simon and Garfunkel had already secured a top five seller with Parsley, Sage, Rosemary, and Thyme. Friends since the sixth grade, growing up in Queens, Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel nevertheless didn't stray far from home when pop stardom arrived. Here's Art Garfunkel in the studio.
Well, I know that until 1967, I was at Columbia University, continuing to be a student, working toward a PhD, actually. And so that kept me in New York during the week. And on weekends, we'd go out. This was particularly October, November, and then again in March and April. We'd go out and do a weekend of shows, like we'd do a Milwaukee Friday night show and a Chicago Saturday night and a Minneapolis Sunday night, and be back in New York by Monday. In these days, my records were taking hold of my life, and it was slowly pulling me away from the sort of academic side. So I was in transition during these days. My real love was not so much the school, and it wasn't so much touring and doing these shows. It was in the recording studio downtown in mid-Manhattan. Those are the years we were making those albums, and that's really where most of the time was going.
So hard to please, but look around, leaves are brown, and the sky is a hazy shade of winter. Hear the Salvation Army band down by the riverside. It's bound to be a better ride than what you got planned. Carry your cup in your hand and look around, leaves are brown now. Sky is a hazy shade of winter. I hang on to your hopes, my friend. That's an easy thing to say, but if your hopes should pass away, simply pretend that you can build them again. Look around, the grass is high.
things are right. It's the springtime of my life. Seasons change with the scenery. We've inhabited a tapestry. Won't you stop and remember me? At any convenient time. Find out my memberships while looking over manuscripts of unpublished rhyme. Drinking my vodka and lime. I look around, decent brown now, and the sky is a hazy shade of winter. Look around, leaves are brown, there's a patch of snow on the ground. Look around, leaves are brown, there's a patch of snow on the ground. Look around, leaves are brown, there's a patch of snow on the ground.
From Simon and Garfunkel's 1968 album, Bookends, that's called A Hazy Shade of Winter. Even with the growing success that Simon and Garfunkel were enjoying halfway through the 60s, they had a keen understanding of just why they were making music in the first place. This fact is best realized when you consider Simon and Garfunkel's reasons for getting involved organizing the three-day Monterey Pop Festival in the summer of 67. According to Art Garfunkel, it all started with a phone call from a guy nicknamed Papa John, and we ain't talking pizza.
John Phillips called Paul and I in 60, what would be the year, 66, 67, knew we were coming out to L.A. and wanted to talk about starting a festival with all free talent. And the idea that it was free talent, meaning it's not a commercial endeavor, the kids are going to know that we're doing this for music's sake and for a grand party sake, was going to be the essence of the show. And I liked it a lot because I thought, take the money element away and you have something that's going to have a nice feeling about it. And we met he and Michelle Phillips, and Lou Adler, who was producing the Mamas and Papas records, and Paul and I. We met in California and talked about this festival we were going to have up in Monterey, and we started making a guest list of who we would invite, and we had a lot of fun coming up with the names of the people as we knew the real great ones were, Otis Redding and the Buffalo Springfield and all these artists that we knew were, never mind what the company says or what it's supposed to be, we felt we knew who the genuine good record makers were. And so we had this great time coming up with the perfect guest list and seeing if they would respond to doing this great show with no pay. And everybody said yes, everybody except Ravi Shankar, who insisted on getting paid. And that was the first festival. Since then, when Woodstock came shortly after that, my attitude was Woodstock is a bit of a copy of Monterey because Monterey was a huge success. In terms of spirit, it was wonderful. A weekend of, about 20 different acts. I had a great feeling about that. When I saw Woodstock, I felt, well, they're already now doing the second. It's a copy. It's the East Coast version of what we did. I always thought Monterey was the one.
Let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. So we bought a pack of cigarettes and Mrs. Wagner pies and walked off to look for America. I said as we boarded a Greyhound in Pittsburgh, Michigan seems like a dream to me now. It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. I've come to look for America. Laughing on the bus, playing games with the faces. She said the man in the gabardine suit was a spy. I said be careful, his bow tie is really a camera.
toss me a cigarette. I think there's one in my raincoat. We smoked the last one an hour ago. So I looked at the scenery. She read her magazine, and the moon rose over an open field. Kathy, I'm lost, I said, though I knew she was sleeping. I'm empty and aching, and I don't know why. In the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America. All come to look for America. All come to look for America.
Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike and wondering if they ever found America, with Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel. Just as they had helped to inspire a generation with the Monterey Pop Festival, Simon and Garfunkel also were greatly affected by the works of their contemporaries. And one album, more than any other, served to alter the way that they approached their music, their craft. That album was the Beatles' incredible Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Once again, here's Art Garfunkel.
Records were treated very seriously in that era when they were that good, and because the Beatles had captured the imagination of the whole Western world, how terrific and creative an album could be was beginning to show that it had no limit. And when Sgt. Pepper came out and it was talked about for quite a bit beforehand, it somehow had us all glued to it. We all bought that record and brought it home that night and sat on the rug and turned up the volume and gave it the kind of attention you give to a film when you sit in your seat and the screen parts and there's the Paramount Mountain. For once, records had that kind of preset psychological position that movies demand. And it was brilliant. It was so creative. You loved the opening track, the use of applause and the collage of sound effects. And then came the second tune, and you saw it was a whole other kind of sound. Now, albums hadn't done that before, keep changing the sound on you. And very few groups had done so many aspects of record making so well, from lyrics to arrangement to engineering to singing to musicianship. So it made an album have a lot of variety, and it affected us. It was a real comparison point for Paul and I to go for an album that had such a creatively varied sound from cut to cut. It expanded what an album could be. I remember it was a huge inspiration to me, and it was a depressant to Paul, because Paul felt, we'll never do anything that good. I'm going to bed.
She goes, she's gone. If she stays, she stays here. The girl does what she wants to do. She knows what she wants to do, and I know I'm faking it. I'm not really making it. Such a dubious soul, and a walk in the garden wears me down. Tangled in the fallen vines, picking up the punchlines. I've just been faking it, not really making it. Is there any danger? No, no, not really. Just lean on me.
taking time to treat your friendly neighbors honestly. I've just been faking it, not really making it. This feeling of faking it, I still have been shaking it. Prior to this lifetime, I surely was a tailor. Look at me.
Good morning, Mr. Leach. Have you had a busy day?
I own the tailor's face and hands. I'm the tailor's face and hands. I know I'm faking it. I'm not really making it. This feeling of faking it, I still haven't shaken it. I know I'm faking it. I'm not really making it.
From the 1968 album Bookends, that one's called Faking It. As a result of the Beatles' influence, Simon and Garfunkel went into the Bookends recording sessions with an eagerness to try new things in the studio. That experimentation led to their decision to use a strange new instrument on the song Save the Life of My Child. Now, they've been known up to this point as a mostly acoustic, somewhat folky group, so it's ironic that Simon and Garfunkel turned out to be the very first musicians to ever record with this new instrument, which was called the Moog synthesizer.
Robert Moog had invented the synthesizer and was having courses in New York for those who wanted to learn about this, and we would go to these classes to learn about this instrument, and we arranged with him to bring the whole thing into the studio. It was an enormous contraption. And we didn't know how to use it. We knew it could make these wonderful sawtooth buzzy sounds, and it could do so many different things, but we said, let's use it as a bass instrument. Let it be a pretend electric bass. A synthesized bass, and we tried to exploit the buzzy sound of the low end. So that's the first time that had ever been used.
Papa, don't jump! The boy sat on the ledge. An old man who had fainted was revived. He's alive. Save the life of my child, cried the desperate mother. A woman from the supermarket ran to call the cops. He must be high on something, someone said. Times in the daily news, a caption read, save the life of my child.
Yeah.
There's the first song ever recorded using a synthesizer that saved the life of my child from Bookends. When we come back in the studio, we'll find out how Simon and Garfunkel got involved with the movie The Graduate. Welcome back in the studio, this week highlighting Simon and Garfunkel's legendary album, Bookends. I'm Red Beard. A few months before Bookends came out, Simon and Garfunkel's music had been featured prominently in the Mike Nichols movie, The Graduate. It was a big hit at the box office. The Graduate catapulted newcomer Dustin Hoffman to stardom. It also set up the release of the Bookends album in the process. I asked Art Garfunkel how Simon and Garfunkel had been fortunate enough to have their song spotlighted in this movie.
Let's see, it started with Mike reaching Paul saying, I want you to come see The Graduate because I see your music in it and I want you to write a couple of tunes. And I had just come back from Europe, and Paul was saying, there's a very funny film with this new actor, Dustin Hoffman, that Mike's got me looking at. I've now seen it a whole bunch of times. Come take a look. And I saw it and laughed, and he said, Mike wants me to write three songs. He wants us to sing them. And here's the deal and such. And Paul wrote a song called Punky's Dilemma, which ended up on our Bookends album, and Mike didn't like it. It was meant to be, if you know the film The Graduate, there's a scene. Dustin is home from college and he's floating in his pool on a float. And so Punky's Dilemma. Wish I was a Kellogg's cornflake, floating in my bowl, taking movies. Kind of a slow jazz, hip, campy, hip tune. Mike didn't quite like it.
Wish I was a Kellogg's cornflake, floating in my bowl, taking movies. Relaxed in a while, living in style, talking to a raisin who occasionally plays L.A. Casually glancing at his toupee. Wish I was an English muffin, got to make the out of a toaster. I'd ease myself down, coming up brown. I prefer poison very more than any ordinary jam. I'm a Citizens for Boys and very jam fan. Everybody knows what he's tiptoeing down there for.
That's called Punky's Dilemma, the song that Mike Nichols, the director of The Graduate, didn't like quite well enough to put it in the movie. Nichols originally intended to include a couple of new Simon and Garfunkel songs in the soundtrack to the film The Graduate. But when all was said and done, the only new track was one called Mrs. Robinson. As Art Garfunkel tells it, even that song almost didn't make it into the Mike Nichols film The Graduate.
In his waiting for Paul to come up with other tunes, because Paul writes slowly and carefully and brilliantly, I may say, in Mike's waiting, he was living with pre-existing Simon and Garfunkel tunes that had come from albums that were already out and syncing them into the movie just as a work print kind of situation while he was waiting for the songs to be – the new stuff, the real stuff to be written. Meanwhile, Mike was loving what he had. He was using Scarborough Fair at the end during this scene and April Come She Will during another scene. And as Mike was living with – these pre-existing Simon and Garfunkel songs, he began to like it and sort of say, don't even bother writing anything because I love what I have and I'm going to take them right off your records and put them in these various places. There is room for just one new tune, though, during the chase scene. And so we were out in L.A. and talking about, you know, we re-sang The Sounds of Silence. He used the exact Scarborough Fair. We didn't have to re-sing that or April Comes She Will. But he was looking for an up-tempo thing. And Paul was beginning to write something that at that point was called Mrs. Roosevelt. Here's to you, Mrs. Roosevelt. And I mentioned to Mike that Paul had this tune, and Paul was not liking it. He was about to drop it. And Mike said, well, it sounds like it's ideal for what I want if we just change Roosevelt to Robinson. So Paul showed him the tune. Mike loved it, insisted he had to work on it. And we then sang it in the soundstage in Hollywood as a song that was only half written. So if, as you know this song from the movie, there's the chorus, but there are no verses because the verses hadn't been written. So there's just doot, 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 doots.
And it wound up being the number one song in America for 3 weeks in June of 1968. And it brought Simon and Garfunkel 2 Grammy Awards. When they did record it for the Bookends album, Simon and Garfunkel used a couple of studio techniques to get exactly the sound they were looking for. However rudimentary, they used 4 different vocal tracks, all layered very, very tightly on top of one another. And to describe another production trick, here's Art Garfunkel.
Remember I said a while back in this interview that in Sgt. Pepper, one was so impressed with the variety of tune after tune on the album went in a different direction production-wise, and this gave the overall album a feeling of being a very varied creative package. So as you when we would record, each tune was a matter of trying to make it different from all the other tunes. Little touches. In Mrs. Robinson, you hear Paul play ba-doo-ba-dab-boom, very nice guitar figure. And we wanted the guitar string to wobble a little. And what Paul didn't do on the bending of the guitar string, we did with a pencil on the actual tape in the tape as we were recording, and it was running through the tape machine. We put the pencil near the capstan and just wobbled the tape itself. In other words, when everything was recorded and it was time to make the mix where you combine all your sounds into one locked set of relationships and you're recording from the multi-track, this is getting a little sophisticated, from the multi-track machine into your 2-track final mix, we would wobble the actual tape in exactly the right amount and the right way so as to create a slight distortion, and we did it on the guitar alone.
Just one of the many experiments that engineer Roy Halley helped Simon and Garfunkel pull off in the studio. Thanks in part to the song Mrs. Robinson, Simon and Garfunkel had the distinction of having both the number one and the number two albums at the same time, Bookends and the soundtrack to The Graduate. I wondered how Art Garfunkel felt about the final version of the song Mrs. Robinson compared to the 2 unfinished mixes that actually appear in the movie.
Well, the song on Bookends is much more my kind of thing where we could stroke it and get it really right. In the movie, it's casual, but on the record, I think it's cute as a deuce. It really is a nicely worked out single. Paul plays wonderful acoustic guitar. People don't realize what a terrific guitar player Paul has always been, and it's central to our hits that he plays such good rhythm guitar. I remember it as we were recording it, and I was in the control room, and Paul was playing guitar out in the studio with Larry Nechtel on bass and Hal Blaine on Kunga. And they were working out the arrangement around one mic, and it was sounding very good. And I took a break just to hit the head. And I came back 5 minutes later and opened the door of the control room, and hitting me as I walked in a flash was the progress they had made in the last 5 minutes. And my ear said, oh, it's fantastic. This is a big hit. They've gelled so commercially, I can't believe it. And I went right into the control room. Roy, you getting this stuff? Is this down on tape? And Roy says, no, let's have them go from the top, or let them finish, and then we'll go around again. Guys, when you finish that take, start again from the top. And they rolled into it from the top, and that I'm sure that was the take we used because they were hot. And that became the core of the track of Mrs. Robinson. There's not a lot added to it when it swings so well in its basic form. You don't really need to add much. Thank you.
sun. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. Yourself. Look around you, all you see are sympathetic eyes. Stroll around the grounds until you feel at home. And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. Hiding in a hiding place where no one ever goes. Put it in your pantry with your cupcakes. It's a little secret, just the Robinson's affair. Most of all, you've got to hide it from the kids. Coo-coo-ca-choo, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey.
Unforgettable character in the movie The Graduate. That's Mrs. Robinson. Up next, we'll learn about the art of record making. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the 10th anniversary of Simon and Garfunkel's number one album, Bookends.
Hi, I'm Art Garfunkel in the studio for our album, Bookends.
And I'm Redbeard. Welcome back. Earlier, Art Garfunkel told us that his first love had always been the making of the albums. So I asked Art to tell me a little bit about what it was like making records.
Well, it was serious work for serious workers. We did night sessions in those days. So we'd come in at 7 or 8 and stop at the coffee machine and then head down to the studio, and there would be the wonderful Roy Halley. And you'd drive down in your rented car and come into the control room. The studio was enormous, because they did a lot of string dates there. And it was fairly modern, one of those wood parquet floor things, and very huge for orchestras of 104 whenever they needed to do that work. But I remember spending most of our time in the control room because from my point of view, I was a record maker, a producer more than anything else. I would, in my own mind, send myself out on mic to do vocals, but the real me was the producer, collecting those vocals and syncing them into the records and thinking what orchestration and what instrumentation is going to be needed, and who should we book, and what shall we have them play, and what's the end? Is this a wet record or a dry record? How much echo? What kind of echo? Where will it be programmed in the album? How will we mix it? So I'm a control room guy, and these were we're workaholics, Paul and I and Roy Halley. Many's a night we'd be rolling by around midnight, really into it. And the really fertile part of the session would be 2, 3, 4 in the morning. You'd be doing vocals, and you'd be up to your sixth hour of singing. Youth is great. By 3 in the morning, And you really wouldn't peak until 6 in the morning. You'd still be getting great stuff on tape vocally after like 8-9 hours of singing. Finally, at 7 in the morning, you'd feel, okay, there's a really good night's labor. And you'd head out and you'd get in the rented car and the sun would be coming up in Hollywood and you'd drive home with a wonderful feeling of excellent hard work went through you.
Someone told me it's all happening at the zoo. I do believe it. I do believe it's true. It's a light and tumble journey from the east side to the park. Just a fine and fancy ramble to the zoo. But you can take a crosstown bus if it's raining or it's cold. And the animals will love it if you do. It's all happening at the zoo. I do believe it. I do believe it's true. The monkeys stand for honesty. Giraffes are insincere. And the elephants are kindly, but they're dumb. Orangutans are skeptical of changes in their cages. And the zookeeper is very fond of rum. Zebras are reactionaries. Antelopes are missionaries. Pigeons plot in secrecy. And hamsters turn on frequently. What the gas? You'll have to come and see at the zoo. At the zoo. At the zoo.
I Do Believe It's True. Bookends is truly a delight to listen to, and the considerable responsibility of getting all those different sounds and effects that you hear throughout the album belong to Simon & Garfunkel's co-producer, Roy Halley, a man that Art Garfunkel holds in high esteem to this day.
Well, Roy is an engineer, a consummate engineer with Rolls-Royce standards. And as you know, standards are everything. Those who hold to perfectionism, knowing that you can get away with much less, but you just can't do it because something inside of you says excellence for its own sake. These are the blessed people for me. And Roy is chief amongst this type. And Roy was this wonderful presence, a little older than us, a little more serious, a kind of a family man, whereas we were nuttier. And very lovable. You know, the fact that he was so damn likable is an important factor. And he was in charge of sounds. And Paul and I got to sort of use him as almost like the big brother figure. We would pitch our ideas to him, and he would be this psychological person that we chose to please with our creativity. And so through the years, I've come to feel it's very important that the creative artist have a creative audience. If there's just one great audience figure that you're playing to, and that person plays his audience role brilliantly, the artist can play his artist role brilliantly on account of it. It helps a lot. So Roy was a wonderful engineer who thought of sounds the moment he began to hear the songs, and in a sense thereby became co-producer, because he did more than just make clean recordings. He made creative sound collages. And I think of him as the third member of our triumvirate.
One thing that makes the album Bookend so special is the common thread that runs through each of the songs. Art Garfunkel still remembers Paul Simon's elation when Paul began to write them.
The concept of bookends, and I remember when Paul started writing it, and he was very excited that it was going to have this thematic element. The concept was to take side one and let there be a bunch of songs that progressed from youthfulness to old age in their lyric, in their feeling, in the tempo, in the spirit of the song. Everything about the opening cuts should represent adolescence, and everything about the final cut should be slow and winter-like. And so that's what that's what Save the Life of My Child is, a kid who flies away, and it's an adolescent theme. And then comes America, and then comes Overs, some sort of a middle-aged marriage gone wrong song. Why don't we stop fooling ourselves? The game is over. You know, so it has this progression through it, and we like that idea.
Why don't we stop fooling ourselves? The game is over, over, over. No good times, no bad times. There's no times at all, just the New York Times. Sitting on the windowsill near the flowers. We might as well be apart. Hardly matters, we sleep separately. And drop a smile passing in the hall. But there's no laughs left, 'cause we laughed them all. And we laughed them all in a very short time. Delay. We're just a habit like saccharin. And I'm habitually feeling kind of blue. But each time I try on the thought of leaving you, I stop and think it over.
That's called Overs. Even in a song about a relationship that's ending, like Overs, there seems to be an undefined optimism, a playfulness in the music and words of Paul Simon and Art Garfunkel on Bookends. Indeed, there was a desire that pervaded the late 60s that had us all, as Paul Simon so aptly put it, looking for America. Unfortunately, as someone who helped shape the music of that era, Art Garfunkel believes that feeling disappeared a long time ago.
Well, remember earlier in the interview I was saying how Monterey was conceived as an offering, a musical offering, more than it was conceived as a commercial enterprise. In the last 20 years, we've seen very, very few things that are conceived as not commercial enterprises. The truth is that rock and roll became a multi-billion dollar business, and businessmen moved in on it. And you have to go back to that earlier era to get a little more of an innocent thing, where music was the emphasis and the love of a great record was the reason for the existence of many a tune. These were not calculated financial bids to make profit. You know, they were about, let's see how great the record can be. Sure, the kids are going to buy it, and they're, you know, commerce is commerce, but somehow that was not the focus. And since then, we've seen the whole thing corporatize itself to the great loss of the spirit of what could be. So when I think of those days, I think of myself as a record maker and the thrill of just everything was the record and how wonderful it could be, and the fact that the Beatles were influencing us. I guess the money was not so big as to be so intrusive.
Don't know that you above me, yeah. What you think isn't always true. Don't try to debate me. You should know that I'm womanly wise. Still you're trying to manipulate me. You don't know where your interest lies. No, you don't know where your interest lies.
You don't begin to comprehend.
You're just a game that I like to play. You may think that we're friends, alright, but I won't let friendship get in my way. No, I won't let friendship get in my way.
Indications indicate running the same riff will turn you around. Obviously, you're going to blow it, but you don't know it.
Bonus for you from us here in the studio called You Don't Know Where Your Interest Lies, that's on the new expanded remastered version of Bookends from Simon and Garfunkel. I'm Redbeard. I'll be back in the studio after this. This is Redbeard in the studio, thanking Art Garfunkel for the conversation. In the Studio was written and produced by yours truly for Redbeard Rocks. Associate producer and engineer Doug Hall. Transcription Jane Carpenter. In the Studio theme by Andy Timmons. You can email to redbeard@inthestudio.net.